I'd like now to welcome Jean Sept. She's a professor of anthropology at Indiana University at Bloomington. She's a paleoanthropologist. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you're studying basically what people ate long before written history. Is mm-hmm. that right? How far back are we talking about?
Oh, my own work stretches back probably 2.5 million years.
And so what kind of people? Were we Homo sapiens back then?
Oh, no. We were proto-human. So we wandered around on two legs, and we had brains. Our ancestors had brains that were much smaller than ours today. But in many ways, we were really already on the road to humanity.
So how do you study that group of people, and especially their diets, which are presumably all biodegraded and returned to Earth millions of years ago?
Well, there are all sorts of different kinds of evidence that provide clues to that ancient time period. Some of it is fossilized, so we find the fossil bones of our ancient ancestors, and some of it are the food remains they've left behind, their tools, and the fossilized remains of things they ate.
You actually have, like what?
Well, it's not very interesting because the tools, the only tools that survived for the most part were rocks, so we have stone tools, and the kind of food remains that are found are the food remains that can be fossilized, and for the most part those are just bits and pieces of broken animal bones, that most of the other garbage from the foods that were eaten has long since rotted away. So we have a really incomplete but fascinating guide to the past. And so part of what my colleagues try to do is to use these clues, like ancient detectives, to try and piece together interpretations of what the lives of these proto-humans were like based on incomplete evidence.
So you're really basically looking at proto-humans as opposed to looking at early Homo sapiens?
Absolutely.
So what do we know about them and the way they lived?
Well, there were many more of them in terms of different kinds of creatures than there are today. Right now, Homo sapiens is the only surviving member of the family that we belong to. But 2.5 million years ago, there were a number of different species. Some of them had different kinds of physical adaptations to diet, but they were all bipeds. Some of them had slightly larger brains than others. So one challenge is figuring out which one of those different kinds of early proto-humans eventually survived and evolved into modern humans. But there were a variety of them back then, so us and our distant cousins.
So what are the names of some of those distant cousins?
Well, many of them have been called Australopithecines, Australopithecus, or sometimes called Paranthropus. It's the genus name. There were a couple of those different species that lived in southern and eastern Africa. And then a couple different members of our own genus, Homo, and they've been given all sorts of varieties of names. And some anthropologists group them all into one species, and some anthropologists split them into different species. But basically there were members of our own genus, and then other cousins, the Australopithecines, or their close relatives.
So the anthropological thinking is that only one of those species is our direct ancestor.
Yeah. They all, we all branched from a very early member of our own own lineage, and that lineage, like a tree, you can trace the roots of our ancestry back to a period probably maybe 7 million years ago, something like that, when we last shared a common ancestor with living apes. And then our own lineage sort of evolved through time and branched. There were many branches on that lineage, and some of them led to these various kinds of Australopithecine, and some of the Australopithecines evolved in different directions, and at least one of those Australopithecines evolved into early Homo, and early Homo branched off in different directions, and one of those members of our lineage eventually survived and became our direct ancestor.
I find myself so curious about how they lived, for example, and how you know about, you know, what we do know about how they lived. For example, how much of their time was actually spent procuring food?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. And the short answer is we don't know for sure. We have models. If you look at living apes, they can spend, half their day looking for food. And so we can assume that a good portion of the time of any of these early hominids was spent looking for food. But all we know is we can study their own fossil remains, and you can learn about what they ate from their morphology, or the shape and size of their teeth and jaws and stuff like that. You can study the chemistry of their bones, and that you often hear the phrase, you are what you eat. That's literally preserved in the chemistry of some of the ancient fossils, as well as more recent ones. And then we find their garbage, their ancient garbage, and that's what archaeological sites are the remains that are preserved of the ancient garbage. And we know a lot about the kinds of animals they snacked on, but we don't have nearly as much information about what kinds of plant foods they ate.
So what kind of animals did they eat?
Big ones and little ones. Some of the earliest evidence is about 2.5 million years old. And there are remains of these small antelopes are preserved in some of the early sites, and also remains of larger animals, things as large as ancient hippos, for example. And you'll find a few bones from these different kinds of animals, and we're pretty sure that they were eating them, because you find evidence that they sliced and diced meat off of the bones themselves. You find ancient cut marks incised on the surface of these bones that then became fossilized. And you also find some bones that have clearly been smashed open with rocks. And today, if you're trying to get marrow out of the cavity of the limb bones of any kind of antelope or mammal, the place to go is the limb bones. They're very rich in marrow, but to get into it, you can't just chew them open. We don't have the teeth for that, and neither did our ancestors. You have to break them open with rocks, and we find bones that have been smashed open with rocks, and you can actually see the damage on the surface of the bone and fit the pieces of the bones together. At some of these sites, they fit back together again, so you can actually, it's like a jigsaw puzzle, you can piece all these remains back together again. So we're pretty sure that they cut meat off of bones and broke open some of the bones for marrow. What we don't know is whether they actually hunted any of those animals, or whether they just scavenged remains off of kills of ancient lions or other sorts of carnivores. And so that's an intriguing question that many of my colleagues are really focused on, is were they hunters or scavengers, or maybe a little bit of both?
So when people were scavengers, when you talk about scavenging, are you talking specifically about meat scavenging of the kind that you just mentioned?
Absolutely, yeah. Today in Africa, the kind of rich animal food, the meat and fat off of a large carcass, is a hot commodity. If you go to Africa today, there are all number of carnivores, various lions and hyenas and leopards, cheetahs, a wide range of large cats and wild dogs that are in constant competition for access to those kinds of meats and other animal foods. And of course, they eat the guts and everything else off of these carcasses. So there's it's very rich food, and there's a hot competition for it. So one of the interesting questions is, could these proto-humans, who after all, they weren't as large as we are, they were smaller in stature, and they didn't, as far as we know, they didn't have any fancy weapons. They had a few broken rocks that they could use, maybe throw at creatures, but they wouldn't have been they wouldn't have been able to necessarily compete fang to fang with ancient lions or other sort of large cats. And so how one question is, how could they have competed for access to meat? Maybe they could gang up and in a sense cooperate socially to scare off animals, or maybe they would just linger on the edges and of woods or whatever and wait for a carcass to be abandoned and then dart in and grab what was left. Those are two possibilities for scavenging. And at our archaeological sites, one of the things you can look for is, well, are there do you find bones of real prime parts of a carcass, really meaty limb bones that suggest they got to carcasses really early before they were completely ripped to shreds by carnivores? Or do you only find that they were getting, you know, bits and pieces of the dregs of a carcass? And sometimes you find bits and pieces, but many of the sites in East Africa, at least, you find parts of carcasses that they must have gotten to the carcass really early to you know, get big haunches and things like that. And so maybe they weren't able to literally hunt big animals, but they were certainly getting early access to carcasses. And in some cases, you find at sites like Olduvai Gorge in Tanzania or some of the other sites in East Africa, you find small carcasses of little antelopes and things that are almost complete at the sites, suggesting that if a carnivore, a wild carnivore, had gotten something like that, they tear the carcass to parts. And so finding almost entire examples of small carcasses that have been fed upon by these ancient tool users suggests that maybe in some cases they were able to hunt small mammals. And that makes sense if you look at our close living relatives today, like the chimpanzees, because they cooperate and they can hunt for animals smaller than themselves. And so many people think that it's plausible that our proto-human ancestors could also have cooperated to hunt for animals smaller than themselves, and only later were they able to hunt mammals larger than themselves.
We're talking to Gene Sept, paleoanthropologist, who's going to be tomorrow night at the James A. Little Theater at 7 o'clock doing a talk called What's Cooking the Meat and Potatoes of Human Evolution? So speaking of, we've been speaking about meat, let's speak about vegetables. What vegetables did our proto-human ancestors eat?
I wish we knew.
Or fruits.
Yeah. Well, one of my own interests really is plant foods, and it's frustrating because none of the plant foods that were eaten themselves are preserved. We have there are very few fossil plant remains at any of these early archaeological sites. In fact, one of the sites that was first described, they found some fossilized fig leaves, and that was an amusing discovery. But the fruit weren't there, so trying to figure out what kinds of fruits might have been eaten, you can make arguments by analogy with close living relatives like chimpanzees or some of the other primates, or you can actually look at evidence from the fossil skeletons of our proto-human ancestors about the kinds of things they chewed. You can look at the wear on the surfaces of teeth, or you can look at some of the chemical signatures in their bones. And that gives you a sense of what the texture of the foods were, what the chemical composition of the foods were, and what might have been plausible. But that's as close as we can get. But so if you take that information, undoubtedly they were getting as many fruits as they could, because all large primates in Africa today basically will eat as many fruits as they possibly can. Chimpanzees, even gorillas, who are well known for sort of being dependent on roughage and on leaves and things, particularly in the mountains of East Africa, but even in the lowlands, they have to survive during a year by falling back on foraging for stems and leaves. Even the lowland gorillas will get as much fruit as they possibly can. So undoubtedly, our ancient ancestors must have eaten as much fruit as they possibly could. But the question is how much fruit was available, particularly in some of these open areas that we know they lived there, in open savanna areas. How much fruit is available, and when fruit wasn't available, what did they survive on? And so if you go into those sorts of habitats today and look at the ancient environmental evidence, it suggests that they could have gone for sort of deeply buried roots and tubers, because those are available even during times of the years when there aren't that many big ripe fruits, and other sorts of maybe nuts or seeds of legumes, which are common in the American Southwest today. I mean, those are the sorts of things that you can often turn to, even though they're harder to get. They take a lot more work to pick seeds off of, you know, trees, or to dig up deeply buried roots. It takes more work to get them, but once you've got them, you can survive on them. And so chances are they ate a wide variety of different kinds of foods. All of them probably did.
So you're classic omnivores, both our primate relatives and our proto-human ancestors.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So where are these archaeological sites in Africa, and how do you find them?
Our sample of sites comes from most of the best sites come from an area in East Africa that one of my former colleagues used to call the Klondike of human evolution. They come from the Rift Valley, which is an area where it's an area where ancient sediments have been naturally exposed. It's an area where the Rift Valley is a place where the geology of the area today has formed a crack in the Earth's surface, and the sides of the rift have uplifted, and the bottom of the rift has basically filled with water. Lakes and rivers form sedimentary basins over millennia. And this combination of areas where you have low-lying sedimentary basins, places where the sort of quiet waters of lakes and rivers can bury the bones and food remains of our ancestors. So that kind of preservation process where things can be fossilized is really common there. And then you have the ancient sediments being uplifted through earthquakes and earth movements. And what you can do is actually walk along the edges of the various exposed hills in the Rift Valley, and it's like walking along the side of a giant layer cake, and you know, little levels of horizons of frosting are coming out at you, and maybe they're chips or bits of raisin coming out of that frosting or whatever. That's analogous to finding fossils in a layer of ancient sediment. And when you do that, then the challenge is you want to be able to dig down and expose a larger area of that level of the frosting, if you will. And so you have to start digging from the top of your piece of cake and dig up and expose as large a surface area of frosting as you possibly can, and see if you can find those artifacts and those different bones where still lying in place where they were actually buried. So the Rift Valley is a wonderful place to go prospecting for these ancient sites because these well-preserved locations are exposed on the Earth's surface today.
The ratio of digging to finding must be pretty high.
I have colleagues who they love looking for fossils, and they love doing the prospecting, and because you can cover large amounts of territory in a glorious part of the world, often these areas are incredibly dry because of the natural climate. But they're just, it's fabulous, and you can find stuff, and it's exciting. Then the real work begins, I shouldn't say that. It's a lot of hard work doing the prospecting, and you're reliant on not only getting to the area, but often these are very large teams of trained scientists and colleagues. And as you go up and down the Rift Valley, you're moving from areas of Tanzania to Kenya to Ethiopia, and there are many dedicated Ethiopians and Kenyans and Tanzanians and Ugandans who they may not have PhDs, but they are outstanding at being able to do this sort of prospecting and to be able to recognize different kinds of fossils, not just fossil proto-humans, but a huge variety of ancient and now extinct animals. And so these teams of fossil hunters go out, and they just do an incredible job of finding these things. But then the second phase is once you've found stuff, and particularly if you've found an archaeological site, and what you want to be able to do is expose the activity area where tools were being used. And so it does take a long time to dig these things up, and it's very careful, painstaking work that's often done with tiny little tools and not large trowels, because the sediments are in many cases cemented. They're extremely hard. It's like digging through concrete. So you have to dig with very, very small tools so that you don't damage anything. And in effect, one little bit of sandy, hard concretion at a time. And it takes a very long time and many, many years often to expose these ancient sites to the modern surface.
Now, do you yourself do that, or do you come in when it's all exposed and then start analyzing?
As a student, I did a lot of digging, and along with many of my student colleagues and the professors I worked with in school, we were doing the digging and the mapping, and then in the daytime, and then recording the materials in the campsites in the evening, and then back again. More recently, I haven't been doing any new excavations myself, but a lot of my colleagues are still digging to this very day. There are a number of active projects going on in East Africa today.
I suppose that's part of the job description, or part of what you have to want to do if you become a paleoanthropologist, is go out in hot areas and dig in the dirt.
Oh, absolutely. And it's fun. It's sort of like gardening in some ways. But as another colleague of mine said, we can speculate all we want to about our ancient past, but the only way we're ever going to know anything for sure definitively is to find new evidence. And that's what the science of human origins is all about, is going out and trying to find new stuff, because for every new fossil or new archaeological site you find, more often it can complement existing knowledge, but more often than not it raises more questions than you'd ever imagine. But that's the only way you can do that, is by finding new stuff. So there's absolutely no substitute for finding new fossil and archaeological evidence. But it's a huge investment of time and energy and money, actually. It can be very expensive.
We're talking to Jean Sept, paleoanthropologist, who will be speaking tomorrow, Thursday, the 9th of April, at the James A. Little Theater at the New Mexico School for the Deaf. The lecture is titled, What's Cooking? The Meat and Potatoes of Human Evolution. So, we have these proto-humans, and they were in, what, tribes, groups, bands? Do we know anything about how big their communities were?
No. Other than assuming that they were probably similar to living apes today, and it probably depended a lot on the kind of habitat they were living in. So, for example, if you look at chimpanzees today, by analogy, chimpanzees in forested environments can often live in much larger groups with smaller territories than chimpanzees that live in open, dry habitats, where their groups can be a bit smaller and where they have to cover huge territories.
Just because there's more food in
exactly.
a forest than in a big open plain.
Yes.
And so, do you have any evidence, for example, that the alpha ate better than the lesser beings?
No. We don't even know who the alphas were. I mean, we're lucky if you can find more than a single individual in one population. And there's some examples of that with sites with incredible preservation, where there's a wonderful site in Ethiopia at Hadar, where the famous near where the famous Lucy specimen was found by Donald Johansson and his team a number of years ago. There's a wonderful site where they called it the first family, because there were a number of different individuals that were all they basically all died together, and so that gives you an opportunity to look at little ones and big ones and males and females and all that.
They all died together. Do we know how they died?
No. but some sort of they were all buried together, so maybe it related to some sort of catastrophic burial process or but we're not sure.
I would think that your work, I mean, you were the ultimate detectives, but it's so there's so little evidence to work with. So you come up with a hypothesis and somebody in the previous generation had another hypothesis and there'll be more to come, but you can't really test your hypotheses. But how do you test them? How do you know what's true?
Well, by looking for more evidence and always putting your favorite ideas in jeopardy. That's what science does. One of the things I'll be talking about at the lecture is from the time period when we just had a single fossil, that was found back in the 1920s, the very first sort of proto-human fossil that was recognized by science, and today we have thousands and thousands of fossils, and we've gone from a knowledge of one species to some estimates are half a dozen different species. But that's all been built bone by painstaking bone, sure that a lot of the ideas that were developed early on we can now discard. We know they were not true.
What are some of those?
The idea that humans are so special that at any point in time there could only have been one of us. It was called the single species hypothesis for many years, because we have the idea that humans are unique. We're rare beings, and therefore very early on in the last century, the idea was, well, there could only ever have been a single species. Well, now we know that's patently not true, because we have many different kinds of fossils that have been found, and through the process of comparative anatomy, you can decide whether or not things were how similar or different they were, and could they have been so similar that they were the same species, or could they have been different? Our dating techniques now are quite superb in terms of being able to nail down really quite precisely the specific age of different fossils. Back in the 1920s, they had no dating techniques, and some of those early sites were from cave deposits, which were jumbled up. And so there are many questions now that we can nail down the time period. We're finding multiple bones, and frankly, the last few years there have been some extraordinary discoveries of partial and almost complete skeletons of individuals. There are examples from East Africa, and an amazing example from South Africa recently as well, where they found the associated remains of a single individual. And early on, that was unheard of, where you might be lucky if you found, you know, a single tooth of an individual or a skull if you were lucky. Well, now they have a number of skeletons where you can compare the stature and how quickly individuals aged during their lifetime, and figure out how old they were when they died, and a range of things like that. So the last couple decades have seen an extraordinary explosion of our understanding of the fossilized remains of proto-humans, and at the same time we've found many more archaeological sites. So we can start to look at the variation between it's like picnic spots. If you based your entire knowledge of human diet on finding the garbage from one picnic, where would you be?
Right.
It depends on what kind of wrappers were left behind and how neat and tidy the folks were if they cleaned up after themselves. But now we have many ancient picnic sites, if you will, and so we can start to compare the kinds of things that were left behind, and we get a better understanding that way.
So in these archaeological rich areas that you were mentioning, you find a site, and then you have to determine, is this 1 million years old? Is this 2 million years old? Is this 1,000 years old?
Mm-hmm.
That's your first order of business. Then you go on from there.
It's often the second order of business, because the figuring out how old it is based on running samples in a laboratory. So your first order of business is doing a careful job excavating, because one of the challenges that all archaeologists are familiar with is the idea that, in effect, you're destroying your evidence as you dig it up. So to be good conservators, if you will, to curate our record of the past well. Our first order of business is doing as careful a job as possible of excavating, of using all the most exacting techniques and recording the information in a way that future archaeologists will be able to get access to as much information as possible.
Do you use a lot of photography?
A lot of photography. Now things are hand, they're plotted in using the amazing digital revolution we're in the middle of. Computers have come to the aid of archaeologists in extraordinary ways, and you can zap the location of artifacts in three dimensions, and then it's wonderful because you can use computers to reconstruct precise maps in three dimensions of the remains that were found. The same thing with fossils now. Often the original fossils are locked away in vaults in their countries of origin, and you can't get access to them without a lot of careful work and permissions and things like that. But one of the things modern physical anthropologists have been able to do is harness the power of computer technology to create three-dimensional digital models, and to use those models to come up with a variety of different measurements of skulls and things, and make those accessible to their colleagues. And so in many ways, the current record of fossils and archaeological sites is much more accessible to scholarship than it was a century ago.
Very interesting. So if everything is online, anywhere in the world can start studying it.
Yes.
We're talking to paleoanthropologist Jean Sept. So when you go back that far, you're talking about the time period before agriculture was invented.
Mm-hmm.
When was agriculture invented?
Now you're testing my knowledge. The people began to do agriculture, so to domesticate plants and animals. It was a process that happened really in many different parts of the world after the end of the last ice age. So if you're in North America, I'm from Bloomington, Indiana, and the ice sheets at the height of the last ice age stretched to within 10 miles of where I live today. And then they retreated north. But at that time period, it was about 18,000 years ago in Indiana, the maximum extent of the last ice sheets. If you'd gone around anywhere in the Americas, everybody was living off of wild foods. They were hunting and gathering. The same was true anywhere in the old world, in Europe or certainly in Africa or the Near East. By 15,000 years ago, you see wonderful examples from different parts of the world of people exploiting the foods that are local to their area much more intensively. There are a couple places in the world where that intensive exploitation had led to a dependence of the plants on human communities, and so you could argue that those were the first examples of really early agriculture. By 10,000 years ago, there are many, many examples of plants and animals that are dependent on people for survival, which is the definition of domestication, a mutual dependence in some ways. And so that happened at slightly different periods around the world, but basically by 10,000 years ago, there were a number of examples of agriculture in different parts of the world. Each locality domesticated its local sort of indigenous crops and animals, and it wasn't until the sort of Columbus in that time period that you actually had the exchange of domesticated plants and animals and even wild foods between the New World and the Old World. So that was all very, very recent.
So examples of domesticated animals are goats, cows, dogs, things like that?
Yeah. It looks like the dog was probably one of the very earliest domesticated animals.
And we may not have eaten so much of that.
We may not have eaten many dogs. They may have helped us acquire animal foods that we did eat. And so it looks like dogs are probably one of the earliest domesticates, and you find examples of dogs buried with human burials, for example, in the Near East and some other places. And now there's fascinating genetics of dogs that's been done, where you can go and arguments are made about how what the antiquity of the genes of dogs suggest about the antiquity of their domestic relationship. But anyway, yeah, so it's a fun.
There's somebody in Los Alamos doing that. We actually had a show about that not too long
ago. Well, there you
go.
Well, your listeners are more familiar with it than I am.
We're talking to Jean Sept, paleoanthropologist. So, stepping back again to these proto-human beings, and we're pretty much talking about Africa. Is that correct? That's where all these archaeological sites are?
And anything older than 2 million years, the entire record before 2 million years of our ancestors is an African record. After about 2 million years, you see examples of early Homo erectus expanding out into other parts of Europe and then quickly into Asia. But they didn't get out of Africa till about 2 million years ago.
And so you find these archaeological sites. How do you reconstruct what the ecosystems were like? Because presumably those things have changed since the people or proto-humans were running around on them.
Oh, yeah. And there's all sorts of neat evidence now. You can, if you're just looking at a local area, you can do soil chemistry, can tell you about the kinds of plants that were living on the soil. You can look at you can get a mix of the different kinds of animals, large and small, that are preserved at the site. So, for example, rodents have very particular habitats, and you can look at an ancient sort of rat and decide if it was a bush-loving rat or a grass-loving rat, and that can help you decide if its burial place was more likely to be a bushland or a grassland. Same with antelopes. You can look at the teeth of ancient antelopes and their limb proportions and other things and decide if they were likely grazers or browsers, and that tells you something about the habitat.
Browsers?
Browsers, leaf-eating.
Okay.
So they're different kinds of antelopes today. Some of them will eat grass, and some will eat leaves off of trees. Different sorts a larger mix.
And so those tell you what kind of vegetation you had at that place.
It was in the region. You can also find fossil pollen. Our hay fever sufferers will not be pleased to know that. No, pollen has an organic component. And then there is the inside of pollen. It's like a little skeleton inside a pollen grain. Those preserve really, really well in ancient sites. And so if you get a good sample of ancient dirt or ancient sediment, and you can process it, and sort of dissolve everything, all the sand grains, all the dirt, often what's left are these little particles of fossil pollen, and sometimes what are called phytoliths, or the silica remains, the things, if you have a piece of paper and you can get a paper cut really easily on the side of your finger, that's because of the little silica in the fine grains of wood chips and whatever else that's been used to make the paper. Well, those little silica particles are often really distinctive to the type, the part of a plant that you're looking at, and so you can find preserved bits of what are called these phytoliths or stones from plant or fossil pollen, and use those to identify the kind of pollen that was blowing around in the wind. Some plants are insect pollinated and they drop their pollen locally, and some plants are wind pollinated and they will often blow hundreds of miles. And so you can get a regional signal. You can find out what kinds of plants grew in the broader region, and you can also sometimes identify local presence of plants that are locally insect pollinated, and so you can get that. And you can also, now there's this wonderful deep sea drilling program that's been all over the world. Often the just as sediments can accumulate on land and in lakes and rivers and things, sediments are constantly accumulating in the bottom of the ocean. So there's this continuous record of sedimentation in the bottom of the ocean. And the Deep Sea Drilling Project has gone around the world and extracted cores of deep sea sediments, and they're often layered very finely. You can date those sediments, and you can study them and see if they have little microorganisms in them, or pollen grains, or sometimes even dust. There are these wonderful examples of deep sea cores off the coast of Africa and West Africa, for example, that shows evidence of sort of violent dust storms and the amount of dust that was in the air at any one time. And the drier the climate was, the more open the habitats were, the more dust shows up in these ancient cores.
Amazing.
That's fun.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
We're talking to paleoanthropologist Jean Sept, who will be speaking tomorrow night at the James A. Little Theater. The title of the lecture is What's Cooking the Meat and Potatoes of Human Evolution? Now, were we, or our ancestors, our proto-human ancestors, competing with primates for the same food?
Probably. If our proto-human ancestors lived in ape habitats, they undoubtedly were competing for the same foods. But one of the interesting things is these early sites that we find, there are almost no examples of apes living in those same areas. There is one ancient...
And no ape fossils.
No ape fossils.
Yeah.
There's one sort of proto-chimpanzee fossil now that's been found in one of the same areas in Kenya. But for the most part, the kind of forested and deeply wooded habitats that apes live in today don't have the kind of conditions for preservation of the bones, and we don't have very many good samples of areas where you have ancient forest sediments that have stacked
right.
up through time. So we don't know whether our ancestors were living in those habitats with apes or not. We're pretty confident that apes were not living in the same habitats as our proto-human ancestors, although we do find different kinds of fossil baboons and other kinds of monkeys. So you find some sites where there are forest-living monkeys that are preserved along gallery forests and rivers, things like that, and some sites that are open sites where you have these different kinds of extinct baboons that were grazing animals, these large gelada-like baboons. And so that's like a paleoenvironmental indicator. But so undoubtedly they divided up their territory and their foods and specialized in different kinds of foods. But yes, they were broadly competing with all the other animals in their communities.
And presumably due to our superior cerebrum size, we're able to outcompete them just through cleverness?
Well, maybe. One of the interesting things is our very first bipedal ancestors had ape-sized brains. So whether or not they were smarter than apes is anybody's guess.
Right.
The first larger-than-ape-sized brains come in with our own genus, Homo. And that's one of the reasons they've been named Homo, is to distinguish them from the Australopithecines we talked about earlier, with smaller brains than ours then or now. So Australopithecines, for the most part, had ape-sized brains. They were bipeds with ape-sized brains. Early Homo had slightly larger brains, and then they expanded quite quickly. And by the time you find this Homo erectus about 2 million years ago, moving out into other parts of the world, they probably could have done it with a little bit of their extra brain power, because their brains were about a third again larger than any living ape.
One of the major preoccupations of human beings living today is diet. For various reasons, including that we want to be healthy and we want to look good and all that kind of thing. What can the work that you're doing tell us about what a balanced diet is or should be or could be?
Well, it's a really interesting question about how different our diet is today from that of any of our ancestors. In fact, a number of individuals have compared have looked at our diets, and they've sort of said, well, so much of our diets today are totally dependent on agriculture and totally dependent on things we've done to food that don't seem quite natural. So our diets today are often Westernized diets today are often much higher in salt, much higher in fat, much lower in fiber than anything you might consider a natural diet for humans.
Well, they didn't have burgers and cheesy puffs.
They didn't have bread. Chances are, when you're living off of a wild food diet, it's one, you're working harder for it, so you're active. Two, it's going to have a lot more fiber in it no matter what you do. And the kind of carbohydrates you get are largely from fruits and from some of the kinds of wild roots that people were eating then are nothing like our modern potatoes or anything else. We've become specialists in packaged starches ever since agriculture, because that's one of the things agriculture has allowed us to do, is maximize the kind of energy content of different kinds of foods. Well, if you're living off of a wild food diet, your starch intake is a lot lower than anything today. So if, you know, it's hard to, there's no reason to try and live off of a purely wild food diet, but we can take the lessons from the past and think about our bodies evolved eating foods that were, you know, lower in a lot of the things, saturated fats, lower in salt and things like that. And so today, if you turn around and eat more, I mean, you've heard this from nutritionists for years, eat more fruits and vegetables, have lean meat in moderation, and try and avoid, you know, the big gulp kinds of sugar intake that we're so fond of. It's ironic because we have a deep primate heritage. We share with other primates a sweet tooth, for example. And imagine you're a monkey living in a forest, and you love fruit and you want to get fruit, and so being able to recognize even the slightest amount of sugar in a fruit is to your advantage. So primates in general have the ability to discover sweetness in their foods, even at low concentrations. Well, we inherited that sweet tooth, the ability to taste sugar, and we love it. But today, we don't need that sugar the way an ancient primate did. And so we love to indulge in it because it tastes so good to us. But with our modern lifestyle, it's not so good for our own health.
When did we, as human or human-like beings, start cooking?
That's a wonderful question. A colleague of mine, Richard Wrangham, has what's become a widely publicized hypothesis now that cooking led to human origins, because he argues that with the pattern of fossils that we find, the quick expansion of the brain size and the kind of teeth that are on these early proto-humans were quite small. So their tooth size is just about the same as ours. So they weren't built to chew their way through the kinds of wild foods that some of our ancient cousins were. So he argues that that cooking, when cooking was invented, it must have been really advantageous to our ancestors because it would have softened food and if you think about some of the kinds of starches, for example, that are common in roots today, they would have been more accessible and more easily digestible once the foods were heated. If you look at living populations of people who forage, at least partly for a living today, and dig up wild roots, for example, their populations in East Africa who do this, one of the things they do is they roast their tubers. And even a short amount of roasting makes the sort of various sugars and complex carbohydrates in the root much more easier for them to digest. So Richard Wrangham said, cooking must have come in at the same time our teeth got small and our brains got big. The problem is there's no evidence for that.
Right.
That the early evidence for fire used for cooking is 1.5 million years younger than our big brains and our small teeth. And so he, in effect, has laid down the gauntlet. He's challenged archaeologists to look for evidence for early cooking.
Well, cooking, among other things, also destroys certain germs and parasites. Mm-hmm. And that leads me to the question of whether we know of any diet-related diseases that our ancient ancestors had or died of.
There have been a few examples of bones where the suggestion was what are called paleopathologies. So in some cases, if you have a disease that is so profound, it can be reflected in the sort of cellular structure of your bones. There's one sample, actually, of a early Homo that has the kind of confused structure in the cortex of one of its bones that looks a lot, they originally thought, like that individual suffered from what's called hypervitaminosis A. In other words, vitamin A. You think it's good for you until you eat too much of it, and then it can cause profound problems. Well, where does vitamin A come from? It's a, in a sense, a carnivore's disease, because vitamin A is concentrated in the livers of other organ meats of animals, and carnivores in particular can get, polar bears, for example, can get a lot of vitamin A concentrated in their livers. And so one of the suggestions was, well, if this pathological bone was the result of getting too much vitamin A, that means that that individual must have had access to some sort of incredible meaty diet that put them way up on the food chain. On the other hand, some others have come along and said that, well, there are other ways of explaining that kind of pathology. It isn't necessarily diet related. So that's the most notorious example of a diet related disease.
Jean Sept is a paleoanthropologist. She's a professor of anthropology at the University, Indiana University at Bloomington. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.